Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Smiley Kaufman for 61.
Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
We are joined by Lance Armstrong. This is a very exciting guest, one that was actually set up by two of my friends that I played golf with at your home club, Driftwood Discovery Property in Austin, Texas. Yeah. And, well, Steven Spieth is one of them, Jordan Spieth's brother. He's a very good friend. And then college. John, yep. How do you pronounce his last name? I just know him as College.
I know. Koryeth is how you pronounce it. Koryeth
is how you pronounce it. Well,
but no, but nobody knows. I mean, you just, there's times you say, John, you know John Koryeth? People are like, no. Then you go, well, okay, hang on, let me try again. Do you know College? They're like, oh, of course.
and that's like, everybody seems to be saying that about College. Just they know him as College. They don't know him as John. Can you give me a little bit more about College and just y'all's relationship? I know this goes back many years.
Man, almost 30 years. I can give you a lot. But my favorite College story, and by the way, he's just going to fall off his chair when he knows that we're talking about him. Like, this is the kind of shit that when he hears this, dude, it's year made. I mean, just the fact that you brought it up. But here's my best College story. So this guy's been, he's been sort of my best bud for 30 years and been, you know, through all of it, man, with diagnosis and all the wins and all the other stuff that followed that. And the guy's just, he's just a solid friend. And, but back in the heyday, going back to 2004, we were filming this show. It was like almost like a reality show. I think it was called The Lance Chronicles, and it was airing on this network that televised the tour. And they follow us around to the races and everything. So we did a race in the U.S. called Tour of Georgia. And we, over in Europe, we have big buses and all the infrastructure. But here in the U.S., we had, and he was a part of the series. Like, he was always my riding buddy. So everybody was kind of getting to know this guy, College. So we're going to the Tour of Georgia, and we have to rent a bus. And I said, hey, man, can you drive a bus? And he's like, fuck yeah, I can drive a bus. I said, okay, good. You're the bus driver. So we go to the Tour of Georgia, and there are, I mean, thousands and thousands of fans every day. And when they see our bus pull up, they just start huddling around the bus by the door because they know we're going to walk out. And this is so good. In fucking College, steps out of the bus one day. And he had been on all the episodes. So people are like, College. And I look out the window, and the sumbitch is signing autographs.
Oh, man.
And he finally comes back in the bus. I said, what the fuck was that? He's like, people wanted me to sign an autographs. I said, okay, all right. Well, here's a question. What do you sign? Do you sign your name? Because your name's John Koryeth. He goes, no, man, I signed College. And I'm just like, you are such an idiot. Get back, drive the bus.
Unbelievable. Hey, Charlie, we got my producer and co-host on as well. Don't get any ideas on this when we're on the road and you start signing autographs and stuff. Yeah. So, Charlie. Yeah.
I got to come up with a catchy nickname. I need like a college equivalent. You know, we've been having a long debate, Lance, about how to pronounce my last name. So, but that doesn't really come through when you're signing an autograph. It looks the same either way. But this is good. This is food for thought. I like this. Thank you for this idea.
And Lance, this is so one of Charlie's, you know, stories, and this is something that is very relatable to you as well. Charlie had testicular cancer as well. And I'm going to give the forward here to Charlie a little bit to kind of talk about his experience a little bit and kind of go have a little back and forth about just, I mean, what it was like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're both here. So that's a good start.
That's right. Yeah. We make an excellent two ball. I hope that joke's not too heavy for everyone out there. Yeah.
But there's plenty of testicular cancer golf jokes if we want to start.
It's a great crossover. It's a really nice, yeah, you know, Venn diagram to be in the middle of. It's so interesting. It's not something that I really talked a ton about publicly, but you know, no better time than now with you to do so. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I just remember that time so vividly, being 23 years old, having this sort of pain in my abdomen and not knowing what it was. And you go in, you get it checked out. And the last thing you're thinking is, oh, they're going to tell you at 23 years old that you have cancer. And not only do you have cancer, but you have a cancer that, you know, is very attached to your masculinity. And there's a lot to kind of, you know, process, of course, at that age. Yeah. And I always felt like you were such a huge role model for me in that time in terms of the way you approached it. Like I just loved, you know, seemingly the way you just absolutely were not going to let the cancer win. And you just had this, like, seemingly this incredible, you know, willpower, just overpower, you know, this disease and what you were going through. And that was something that I really kind of tried to emulate in those moments. But the thing that I maybe, you know, found interesting as sort of a knock-on effect were just those emotions that were maybe underneath the surface. And I think, you know, interesting ones, really. Like, I think I had sort of a guilt, because I had a diagnosis. I caught it early. I had surgery. I had surveillance. I never had to do chemo or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the experience you had to go through, guys like Joel Damon, you know, tour pro. I talked to with him about this at the RSM Classic this last year. Just, you know, how real is my cancer if my experience didn't match, you know, the depths of what you all had to go through? I thought that was one interesting thing. And then another thing is just, you know, you have that initial support that you feel from everybody in your sort of your family, your team, your friends of just that are all there for you in those initial moments, the surgery, rushing to your aid, you know, checking in on you. But then kind of as it trails off over time, where it's just you going to those appointments and doing the surveillance and just kind of sitting there with your own sort of anxiety or, you know, doubt or depression, you know, so I guess all that's by way of saying is just when I wonder how you experience those under the surface emotions, you know, that kind of existed beneath that sort of that drive and that willpower you showed so publicly going through it. And then maybe secondarily, when you get to talk to young guys who are dealing with cancer, with testicular cancer, you know, how you talk to them about being strong, but also coping with those kind of very real emotions that exist underneath.
Yeah. Well, to your first point, I mean, survivor's guilt is a very real thing. That is not a made up thing. It's, you know, you can look it up and read about it. It's a real thing. And of course, but also your situation, is no different, right? It's different in the sense that you were lucky to be, either catch it early or be self-aware enough to say something, right? To go to the doctor or ask somebody or whatever led you to diagnosis. I mean, you could have been an idiot like me that just ignored it forever. I mean, dude, the symptoms going back, I mean, if I walked you through the symptoms and then walked you through all of the excuses that I made up to myself, I mean, duh, no wonder I got so far gone. But I guess that's sort of been a theme of my life. But and then with regards to just talking to folks, look, I viewed my experience. I've obviously been a sportsman my whole life, still am a sportsman. So I just viewed it like a competition, right? And if whether I was looking at a scorecard or a scoreboard or a stopwatch, I was using from the very first day that I took tumor markers or looked at a chest X-ray, I just viewed that as my scoreboard. So as those tumor markers were dropping, I was like, you know, this, of course, I'm making this up in my own head. I'm looking at the scoreboard. I'm like, damn, all right, I'm up 14-0. Now, they may make a run in the third quarter. I don't know. But and then, you know, next round of tumor markers, shit, I'm up 28-0. I know they still might come back on me, but, you know, you just keep playing offense. And so I viewed it. And then ultimately, when the tumor markers dropped to zero, which, you know, is what ultimately you want to see. I mean, it was, yeah, it's but that's the way my simple mind as an athlete viewed it.
And during this time, Lance, I mean, just this was 1996, if that sounds right to you. I mean, really, during that time, I can't imagine that talking about testicular cancer, just the masculinity of just speaking upon, you know, having a diagnosis like this in today's day and age, I imagine so many men would be so comfortable talking about something like this. But back then, was that something that you looked at as a challenge to make sure that other people felt comfortable as a man going through something like this?
I mean, I never, it's a good point and a good question. I mean, I get the sensitivity of it and, but I never worried about it. I mean, I was already a very public figure. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I was going to go hide out for a year and say that I have a blown knee. I mean, it was going to be well documented. And so I just said, look, this is my story. I never had any insecurity around that. I mean, it's been a long time since I actually went back to those days and really thought about it. But maybe my story was a shift where it was, look, it happened. We know that it happened in the breast cancer movement, right? If you go back, you'd have to go way back because that's such a powerful force of women today, right? But if you go back 50 years, you know, I suspect, I wasn't tracking it then, but I suspect women were like, this might be embarrassing, right?
That's a good point.
I don't want to tell my neighbor that I have breast cancer or my coworkers or, you know, much less be a highly visible and public person and make that announcement. But, you know, enough women said it. The Pink Mafia became what it became. The Komen became the amazing foundation and charity that it became, and it empowered all of these women. And I really, now that, again, I haven't thought a lot about it in a long time, but looking back on it, you know, maybe what they did for Pink and breast cancer and Komen and all these things, you know, I was able to do in some way with my own journey and as well as with Livestrong.
Yeah, and that's such a great point. You talk about the breast cancer as well, but I mean, I think you definitely carry the weight of a lot of men that maybe didn't feel comfortable talking about having testicular cancer. So I'm sure there's plenty of guys out there listening that they're thinking they're lucky stars that they felt comfortable enough. So,
mine was so far advanced. I know there were days I was like, I don't give a shit what anybody says. Like, I just got to get out of this thing. Like, let me just get back to doing the stuff that I love. You can crack joke you want, but let's just, I want to wake up in 5 years and 10 years and 20 and 50 years and have a family and do all of these things. And, so that was heavy on my mind.
Yes. And this is sort of a chicken or egg question here. Do you feel like your battle with cancer made you a better competitor did your competitive nature better equip you to battle cancer?
No, I changed as a competitor afterwards. As I just told you all, I viewed it as a competition, right? It is me versus them. And there's going to be a winner and a loser here. And in the game of life and in the game of fighting cancer, winning means survival and losing means death. And so I took that back to my sport, and which on the competitive side, and of course my story has been well documented, on the competitive side, whether it's training, racing, whatever it was wildly helpful to me. Now the problem is not everything in life is a competition. A press conference is not a competition. An argument with a former teammate is not a competition. That's just life. Like, just fuck it, let it go. So it doesn't, those are not wins and losses. Those are not life and death. Now, winning the Tour de France, yes, that's your job. You're paid to do it. You train to do it and go do it. But when it's over, like, just be you, just be the man. And so I didn't have an on and off switch when it came to having that sort of killer competitive instinct.
And college sent me over a couple of different things. First off, I talked to him on the phone for probably an hour yesterday, mainly catching up, mainly talking about you, him telling stories. I mean, that honestly could have been a podcast in itself, some of the things that he was talking about.
Don't ask him. He will drop anything he's doing to be on any podcast.
Well, we might have to someday, because he sure told some incredible stories. And he sent me a cool video, and the video, it was like top five most watched sporting events of all time. And the guy could not figure out what the number one sporting event was. And I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, what's the answer? Even though I knew probably had to do something with cycling. And obviously it was the Tour de France. Yeah. And I guess I'm just so fascinated that I'm sitting here with, you know, one of the best of all time. And just from all of the years that you were over there riding at the Tour de France, is there one memory or just one day or one moment that sticks out like a sore thumb that just like you constantly think about why that event is so, whether it's crazy or what something about just a memory that sticks out to you?
I mean, the one, and I've talked about this kid a few times, but they're mostly good memories. I had a few bad days that I can clearly remember, but my favorite story was, it was probably 2000. It was 2001 on Alpe d'Huez, which is the most popular climb in France outside of maybe, that and Mont Ventoux. But, there's a million people on the side of the road on Alpe d'Huez. And not a lot of them were, this was 2001, so I was trying to win the third tour. I was already public enemy number one. These fuckers are like throwing stuff and yelling stuff. Well, and it's 21 switchbacks. So it's a beautiful climb. It's a very, very famous climb. And if you went on Alpe d'Huez, it's a really big deal. And so there, you can see everything. I mean, the people are right on top of you. If you've ever watched the tour, you see how close the people get. There's a little lull, and I see this kid with an American flag, and he starts running beside me. And it's steep, so you can run as fast as we are riding. Now, he couldn't run the whole way up, but he's running, and he was running good, and he's yelling at me. He's like, "You're the fucking man. You're the fucking man." Like over and over and over. And I'm like, "All right, dude, I got to get this guy to stop. Like, how am I going to, I can't look at him and say stop." But I'm also worried about him. Like, if some of these aggro fans see him, they'll just clothesline him. I'm like, this kid's got to stop. And he keeps yelling it. And so I'm like, "Fuck, I got to get him to stop." So I finally look over and I go, "I know." And he stopped. And he literally stopped him in his tracks. He was like, "What?"
Is there a video of this? Like, can I find this on the internet somewhere?
But it's funny enough, I've run into the guy somewhere. He came out, I don't know where it was, at some event. He said, "You probably don't remember this, but I was 2001. I was running beside you." And I said, "Were you the guy yelling, 'You're the fucking man'?" He goes, "Yeah, that was me." It was just amazing. But
was it the same airport where you saw Vince Vaughn to help him win the dodgeball title? I'm sure it was probably the same, same day. What was Vince Vaughn's character? Why am I going blank on that? What was his name?
Peter LaFleur.
Peter LaFleur.
Peter LaFleur from dodgeball. I actually ran into Vince a few months ago in Miami, and what a guy, what a good guy. But that was another highlight. Man, think about it. If I don't show up in dodgeball, right, the movie's over.
Oh, it's dead. Dead in the water.
The movie ends. Everybody likes this movie and thinks it's funny. If I don't roll up on him in that airport lounge, it's over.
It was a big deal. It was like one of the best cameos of a comedy movie of all time. Just, Lance Armstrong. Like, of course I'm going to go back and win the dodgeball title.
He said, so Ben Stiller was an old friend of mine and still is. And so he asked me to do it, and they sent me the script, and life was busy and I'm all over the place. I said, "Shit, I'm not going to read this." I said, it's line by line. And so I show up and Ben says, "Okay, you ready?" Of course, he was in it and directing. And I said, "Yeah, I'm ready. Like, just go ahead. Feed me the lines. Like, give me one line at a time." And he says, "What?" I go, I haven't had time to read it. I said, "Just feed me each line and I'll say it as best I can." He goes, "Dude, no. This is a dialogue. Like, we can't feed you the lines." I said, "What?" And Vince Vaughn was standing there like ready to shoot. And he goes, "Dude, come with me." He says to Ben, "Y'all go do something else. We'll be back in an hour." So we went to his camper and we just rehearsed this dialogue over the course of an hour. nailed it and walked back and walked out there and did it. I don't know what I was thinking.
Movie star Lance. That's what I'm talking about. That's awesome. That's it was an all time movie, man. I'm glad you nailed your lines because you definitely made it even better.
I had a good teacher in Vince Vaughn.
That's awesome.
A good coach.
Well, this I spent some time around Tom Brady on a golf trip, and I think anytime I've been around people that have been great in whatever they do, whether it's sports, business, you always walk away, or at least I do. And I realize why they're great. Hmm. And for me, even with Tom, I said, this guy would rather die than to lose. And that was the takeaway I took from Tom just playing golf. And there's a book, Jim Collins wrote it, Good to Great. Yep. And this is actually college told me this story. And he said, within the first 3 minutes of him meeting you, he said that you would rather... Or just winning for you is like a 4 out of 10, but losing for you is like a -1 million out of 10.
Right.
Would you say that's pretty fair?
Yes, that's very fair. I always loved, look, I had to win, right? That's what I was paid to do. That's what the fans wanted. And I wanted to win too. I'm not trying to minimize that, but the thing that I do think that, just in my limited time around Brady, I think he probably shares this. The thing I loved more than actually showing up and doing the job and winning was the process. Mm-hmm. Like I loved the months leading up to it. I loved going to the mountains and previewing, like, you know, that day I told you there's a million people on Alpe d'Huez. Well, I was there a month before and there was nobody on it. I had the whole place to myself. Mm-hmm. Like you see occasionally another cyclist, but nobody knew you were, you know, and you had it all. You're just running this process, like, that part. And then I love that. And still to this day, I'm a big believer in process. And when, you know, all 7 of those years, when they would finish in Paris, you know, I'd just be in the bus, man. And everybody be out popping champagne and yelling and screaming and taking photos. And they'd find me in the bus. They'd say, what are you doing? I said, dude, we're done. Like, process worked. We achieved what we were supposed to achieve. Like, I want to go home. I want to go home and hang out with my homies, and I don't need to be around a million people. Like, yeah. It's over.
Wow. That's so well said. And, I think people often talk about golf and how it's a mental game. And I think as it relates to professionals, mentally preparing yourself to succeed 4 times a year. And you kind of just talked about, the Tour de France and just the having to peak for that event and the process that goes into it. Do you see any parallels between that challenge and the mental preparation required to endure a 23-day race and what these guys face 4 times a year?
It's hard for me to say.
Different challenges, right?
Yeah, and it's hard for me. I mean, I watch, my wife can tell you, she thinks I'm the biggest loser of all. Like, I watch golf all the time.
I love it. That means you listen to me a little bit.
I do listen to you. I love the game. I love playing the game. I love watching the game. But obviously the majors, I've never been in that position. I've stood over. I mean, I don't just play golf. I prefer and pretty much only play the game unless if there's money on the line. So, you know, we don't play crazy games, but there's times where you got to stand over a putt, or, you know, there's been a hammer thrown and then a hammer thrown back and you're like, God, you know, that's the extent of my golf pressure, right? It might be $500 or $1,000, but I cannot imagine being at a place like Augusta where all those folks and so much on the line. I'd crack 100%, 100%.
But you are wired to be a champion. So there's some connection here. Like, for instance, like Tiger Woods, when I watched him growing up as a kid and watching him on TV, you turn the TV on expecting Tiger Woods to go win that day. And the same was for you. When you turn the TV on, you expect Lance Armstrong to win that day. And yep. I think he
expected to win.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't speak for Tiger, but I didn't expect to win. I knew I was going to win 100%. I mean, it would have taken a serious accident or surprise illness, but I was 100% sure I was going to win.
And is that just because of your preparation, just knowing physically, mentally, you were just stronger than everybody else?
Yeah. I mean, I'd tell guys, we'd get new guys on the team, and these guys, you know, after three or four of these in a row, you'd get a new guy on the team. I'll never forget, we had this Spanish kid came on the team. Chechu Rubiera was his name. Very, spoke really good English too. And we were at training camp in January, and I said, "This is January. The Tour de France is in July."
Yeah.
And I said to him, I said, you know, I'm going to win again, right? And this, he about fell off his bike. He said, I said, no. I said, I promise you, I'm winning again. Like, I was so sure. And looking back on it, it's kind of crazy because there is a lot of shit that can go wrong. I mean, it's not a, you got 200 guys out there and crashes happen, mechanicals happen. And,
right.
But yeah.
And I'm sure you've been asked about the doping stuff a million times, and I'm here, not really here to talk about that. That's not my place. As an athlete though, and as a competitor, kind of like how we've been talking, mm-hmm. was there one point in your career, whether it was, it had to have been early, obviously, where we just talked about how you physically and mentally are better than everybody else. Was there a point where, whether it was another racer or somebody else that started putting up times or started beating you more often than not, where you're thinking to yourself, I have no chance to beat this guy because of the advantage that he has against me. Is that kind of what led to all of the stuff that
For sure. I mean, it took over not just cycling. It took over pretty much every endurance sport. Right? You had a drug called EPO that was wildly beneficial and undetectable. And so anybody and produced massive amounts of red cells. And so if you were running a marathon or riding the Tour de France or whatever, you know, running an Ironman, it was going to help a lot. And so this hit us in the early 90s, right? And so I was right when I went to Europe. So I wouldn't frame it quite the way that you did in the sense that I was just a young kid. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't, young kids are supposed to get beat, right? That's what happens when you're young in a game. But from 93 to 94, it was such a massive shift. And I'm like, what is going on here? And then we figured it out. And we spent the whole year of 94 going, well, surely this is, you know, like they test for all these other things, they're going to test for this thing. It'll be all fine. And they couldn't figure out the test for another 6 or 7 years. And finally, we just, look, I mean, as unfortunate and as ugly as it was, none of us wanted that, right? Mm-hmm. None of us as young kids said, boy, I can't wait to go from Plano, Texas to Europe and take a bunch of drugs, like, or from Stuttgart to France or from Milan to France. Nobody wanted that, right? That we all got thrown into it and almost everybody made the same decision. And I went over ready to fight with my fists, and next thing you know, they busted out the knives and guns. And I'm like, all right, hang on a second. Like, what's my option set here, right? One option is just to bail and go back to Plano. I wasn't going to do that. Too much of a fighter. So I walked on down to the gun shop and the story is, of course, and by the way, I don't mind you asking. It's such a part of my journey, and right. I talk about it all the time. At the end of the day too, I think my peers would agree with me on this. In fact, I know they would. You know, if we all went out there and raced on bread and water, the results are the same. They really mm-hmm. are. And
I was about to ask you that. I was going to say, if we remove any type of performance enhancing drug or whatever it was that y'all were using, I was going to ask it, would you be winning as much as you did? And there we have the answer.
I do think, of course, I'm biased and I'm me, and that's probably an expected answer. But what we do know, right, is an event like the Tour de France, it is like the Masters, right? You have events in sports, right? Whether it's the Olympics, the Masters, the Tour de France, the New York City Marathon, these are iconic events. Mm-hmm. And what is an iconic events always have one thing. They always have a winner, right? And in most events, if somebody's disqualified or whatever, well, somebody else is going to be named the winner. Well, we have 7 years of the Tour de France, which again is this iconic event that does not have a winner. So to sort of support what I said, you know, you had 200 guys every year for 7 years. So there's a lot of guys. How many of them stood up and said, well, give it to me? I deserve it. I didn't do anything. Not one. Not one person. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, nobody ever came and took the trophies and the jerseys. And so they're around here somewhere.
I'd love to see him one day. That's pretty cool, actually. I'll give you some golf gear for letting me take a peek at some of that stuff. How's that sound?
Okay. Good.
All right. So one other thing that college mentioned to me that I thought was super interesting, and as somebody that constantly has knots and I'm just always hurting, he mentioned that you're like lactic acid, like you don't produce lactic acid. And that blew me away. And for people that don't know what lactic acid is, I'm not really so certain what it is, but all I know is at the end of a day, you're supposed to flush your lactic acid. Right. And you don't hardly produce any, is what I understand.
So this is how I explain lactic acid to people, because it is for a lot of people confusing. If you just imagine you went out in your neighborhood and you found the biggest hill that you could find, and you said, I'm going to run up this hill as fast as I can. Well, you should try that. And as you're running, right, you're going to start sprinting, and all of a sudden you're going to start slowing down, but you're going to keep sprinting, mm-hmm. and then you're going to slow down more. And then eventually you're going to stop, right? The thing that's stopping you is lactic acid. So this is building up in the muscles and preventing them from working. So we all produce lactic acid, even I do. Now, the if you look at my career and people have tried to analyze, you know, what we all as athletes have something that makes us special physically, right? You could look at Michael Phelps, right? Phelps is triple jointed. Phelps is it has huge feet, you know, et cetera, has a much wider wingspan as compared to his height. So he has these physical attributes that made him who he is. That is in the lactic acid scenario or situation was sort of my secret sauce. Now, I did produce lactic acid, but the key for me was that I was able to buffer lactic acid quicker than other people. So cycling races with 200 people and you're going up and down the mountains, right? So it's very dynamic. We can't control. We were 9 guys on our team. So we cannot control what the other 191 guys are going to do. So they control the tactics and the pace of the race. So you're constantly having to deal with lactic acid. And I was just able to buffer and clear the lactic acid better than most.
That's really interesting. And so that help you with recovery as well? Or is that affect recovery?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's one of the big things is that you could recover quicker and as well as the muscle stuff like you just talked about. Well, that's fascinating. But what also is fascinating is I want to hear about when you got started in the game of golf, because I hear you started with Chuck Cook about like 10 years ago getting lessons. And the way it was told to me was that he wanted you to start practicing some 50-yard shots. And you said to him, I don't know about all that, because you even said it earlier. He said, I'd rather be out on the course gambling. 50-yard shots, it's like me riding a bike indoors.
Yeah. He said, you got to go to the range. I said, fuck that. I said, I ride my bike outside. I don't ride it inside, Chuck. God, I love that guy. Here's the backstory. And this is the true story. And it's very special. When I say I love the game of golf, I mean it. Like I credit the game of golf with really helping me get through an incredibly difficult time in my life. And so I did start 10 years ago when my whole world fell apart, and I actually didn't really even like, I had clubs and I'd play once a year and I was like, I don't really like this game. Shouldn't it just be 6 holes? Why the fuck's it got to be 18 holes? That's too much. And so my world falls apart, and I'd say to myself, literally, I said, all right, dude, you're about to have a lot of time. Like all your sponsors are gone. All your commitments are gone. You're going to have nothing but time. What are you going to do? And I know me. I know that I have to do something with my time. Otherwise, I'll go crazy and everybody else around me will go crazy. I said, you know what? I'm going to learn how to play golf. And so I paired up with Chuck and started taking some lessons. And the game of golf filled my days. And I fell in love with the game, every part of it, right? The equipment, the strategy, the pros. It sounds corny, man, but the game helped me immensely at a time in my life where I needed something, right? I just needed something to sort of obsess over and just fall in love with. And that hasn't changed. Like my life has changed because, you know, the world has allowed me an opening and I'm back doing some fun stuff. So, but man, if I get 5 hours and it ain't raining, I'm on the golf course. I promise.
Well, I hope you're getting into college and Stephen Spieth's pockets, because those two, they're two.
This
two
guy's Spieth. All right, let me tell you about our round the other day. So it's me and Spieth, college, of course. This funny comedian, Ron White, who I'd never played with before, and our friend John Callahan. And Stephen Spieth is a good golfer. He's a plus one. Obviously, everybody knows his brother's an excellent, legendary golfer. And I had to text him after the round. I was like, did you break 90? And we're playing a, I'm not kidding, man. He couldn't hit anything. We're playing a 5-man wolf game. And as wolf goes, well, who made all the money?
Oh, I'm sure
Stephen
he did.
Spieth.
He did.
He couldn't break an egg. It was unbelievable. But
college said, was this the same round where you hit it in the creek on 18 and then hit into a bunker? For right now, I've heard your bunker game is not a good place, so we might
It's so bad.
but he said you hit a bunker shot over the green and then make the putter chip for a 5-net 4. Was this the same round? Like, was that this was, all in the same
was,
day?
Yeah, that was the same round. Yeah, I did. And my short game has gotten better outside of the sand part. But and I just got new gear. I like went to this. This is the most time I've ever been on the range. So college, your boy set me up with this club fitter here. I played PXGs forever and very close with Bob, but I'm going to go down to this guy and he did, I had to sit. The guy texted me the schedule and I said, this guy's got to be kidding me. It was two-hour sessions on the range. I'm like,
that's too much for you.
I said, I can't stand on the range tried all the different combos, shafts and heads and all this shit. And I did it and I said, I don't care what they are. I don't care if they're Walmart golf clubs. As long as this shit works, I'm getting them. And I'll sit here with you two times, 2 hours. And so I got all new sticks and it's been cool, man.
The quote I heard on 18 after you did make it was, stars close the show.
I didn't say it that day. I say it all the time though. Look, when you're out playing golf and gambling, you gotta talk shit. I mean, I love talking shit, but I love that part of the game. And but here's the thing, you don't always close the show, but if you do, I give it a big wind up and most people have heard it 20 times. I'm like, hey, Smiley, like you ever seen the Rolling Stones, right? But what happens when you go to the Rolling Stones, right? You go to the concert and there's some small band that opens, right? And they kind of play for a little bit on this little ass stage and then they go off for 45 minutes. And then what happens? The fucking Rolling Stones come out. Mm-hmm. Right. You know why? Because mm-hmm. the stars close the show. And again, my poor friends have heard it 50 times. They're like, dude, shut up.
I tell you what, you need that too in a wolf game when you reorder and then the order changes. So 15, 16, 17, 18 is where you make your money. So it's exactly plays into a good wolf game as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not, my index is 9. So I get, if you're playing somebody that's a scratch, I'm getting, I get some shots, but you can, believe me, you can mess that up too.
100%. You
know, yeah.
Well, Steven's a good player though. Like you said, he's taking my money out there, drew a foot a time or two, and he's a heck of an athlete. So shout out to Steven as well for helping get this set up. And
I didn't realize he played, I just assumed he played college golf.
No, and basketball.
I said, where'd you go to school? And he said, Brown. I was like, oh, you play golf there? And he goes, no, I play basketball. I was like, what?
Oh, yeah. Heck of an athlete.
Yeah.
Heck of an athlete. He also likes talking trash, too. So give him credit there.
Dude. Yeah.
And golf. So you kind of mentioned it a minute ago. But, I mean, do you enjoy the competition side of it more? Or is it the game that you enjoy? Or is it just kind of the combo of both?
I love the competition. I love being on a golf course, right? Mm. It just if I lived on a golf course, I still run a lot. So if I lived on a golf course, I would run on the golf course every day. I wouldn't go out and run around the neighborhood. I'd go early and get out there before anybody, and I'd it's run beautiful. On the golf course.
Like the smell too. I love the way a golf course smells.
Yeah.
Especially in the morning.
And I love golf trips. I love, The boys want to load up and go to Palm Springs. Let's go. Like Madison for 3 days, 36 a day. Absolutely. We have a fun, my guys would kill me. We created, me and a buddy who is college can tell you about, his name's Chad Mountain. He's old golfing buddy of mine. And he was really with me when I discovered the game of golf, and it was this low point in my life. Chad Mountain was there. He goes by Chad O. Everybody in my life has a son. His name is Chad O. So, and we were playing Kukio on the Big Island. We had a house there, and we were out on the course. And, you know, it's a beautiful course, overlooks the water. And he said to me one day, he just stopped. He says, look over there. And I look out, it's just nothing but water, just the Pacific Ocean. And he says, that, my friend, is the view from the lowest point in your life. And he was right. It was a very low point, and that was my view. And I said, boy, okay, I can work with this. I can come up from here. But that is a very serious story. Not so serious is we would play every day, for not much money. But whoever lost had to be, what we call the DB, which is the drink bitch. So that means if you lost, you had to just fetch drinks for the rest of the night. And then that idea evolved. And then we bought this really stupid shirt that, I mean, you wouldn't be caught dead in this thing. And if you lost, you had to be the DB and you had to wear the shirt for the night.
Oh man.
And so after a few years, we're like, we should make this a tournament. And so we then took it to four guys, and then we took it to eight, and now it's 12, and it's, you know, his brother and his brothers-in-law and Blake Griffin. And just a bunch of dipshits. There's 12 of us. We do it in Colorado. This year we had to have two airplanes get us all around. So we started at Ballyneal, where I've been a member for many, many years. And then flew back to Vail, played Frost Creek, and then finished up in Aspen. So, and now we have four shirts. So of the 12, four of the guys have to wear the low, you know, and we have a whole scoring system. The low four have to wear these shirts, and the shirts have gotten worse, by the way. They haven't been the same shirt. Like these shirts.
And then getting more crude.
This one this year is, and then we upped it, and we got golf shirts. So the losers not only have to wear the shirt and fetch drinks the entire night before, but then the next day they have to wear the most heinous golf shirt you can imagine out on the course. And so that's now the DBI. That's the Drink Bitch Invitational. It's a very prestigious thing. You guys are, I'm happy to take it to 16 if anybody listening wants to.
Absolutely. Twist my arm. You know I'm in. So are you the guy keeping the score? I know I've heard that you're the guy that can very good with keeping the all track of all the bets and the scorecard. Is that a strength of yours?
Yeah, it's I love numbers. I always have, even going back to my cycling days. I mean, everything we did was a number, right? Whether you're getting on the scale and looking at how much you weigh, which is very important in our sport, or, you know, your power meter and just figuring out numbers. I tell the guys, I said, I am Ernst and Young, right? And I hate when you get in a group and say, I got the Wolf game. You have five guys. You know, all of a sudden you're playing carryovers. The guy's screwing up the scores. Like, I have a system down. It's dude, I don't mess up the scorekeeping. And I love it. People are like, that's not right. I said, you want to bet? I guarantee you it's right. And then the other guy starts drinking and he fucks up the score. I'm like, dude, I got it.
What's the game that you normally play? Like, you say you have a system. Like, what's the game?
We mostly play Wolf.
Okay.
We either play four or five man Wolf.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
with all the add-ons. Like, I don't like, hey guys, I don't want to play Hammer. I'm like, shit, I didn't come out here to not play Hammer. Like, we are playing Hammer.
Thank you. That's well said.
You know, I mean, every add-on you want. I mean, Hammer, rehammer, birdies, double.
Oh, there's nothing better than a good rehammer, too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you said you hammer. Oh, we're gonna hammer right back after you make that 40 footer on the edge of the green when they're inside of 10 feet, and then you end up getting the double double.
I tell the boys, I said, you make this. I said, I got it polished up. I'm ready to throw it. Just make it, dude. Let's go.
And that's when you just give the old screech across the golf course, and everybody can hear it.
I had my first hole in one about 9 months ago
in Nanea, right?
At Nanea. Let me tell you something.
That place looks beautiful.
It's so funny. Like we were talking about the tours and what it was like to win. And now I was like, all right, this shit's over. Let's go home. Like I was like, all right, let's go. Let's get out of here. Like making a hole in one. I've never made one. I've holed a bunch from the fairway and, you know, from that sort of distance, dude, when I made, I mean, I've never felt a rush like that as an athlete. It was, and we were colleges there. My buddy Seth and Willie were there, and we were literally tackling each other. It was epic. And I was like, as soon as I hit it, the caddy, he's like, oh, he's one of the Hawaiian guys. You know, he's like, oh. And I'm like, what? I'm like, man, I felt good. And it, as soon as he hit the green, he's like, this is going in. And the fucking thing just disappeared. And I'm like, we just started tackling it. It was unbelievable.
Okay, so college told me the part of the story, though. On the eighth hole, you asked everybody how many hole-in-ones everybody else had. And you said for three holes, you were like so down in the dumps that everybody's had all these hole-in-ones and you hadn't had one yet. And then you dunk it on 11.
That's amazing. And I was hungover and I went and we made the turn. I said, there's only one way to feel better. I said, fuck it, I'm going to have a beer. And so I had a beer and God, it was just so good. Can't wait to have another one.
I hear there was a rule put into place that night as well that said you could not continue to talk about the hole-in-one because you were still just so about making an ace.
Willie told me that because the day before I played really good. And I, at dinner that night, I said, guys, I mean, I just do. People think I can be very, very serious, but most of the time I'm just an idiot. Like I just goof off. But so at dinner, I'm like, hey guys, I don't know if y'all noticed or not, but I'm playing really good. And then like 20 minutes later, I was like, hey, has anybody noticed that I was playing? Like I just kept saying it. And so finally they were like, dude, and Willie's this older German guy, like a real German. He's like, that is enough. Shut up. I'm like, and then fucking next day, hole in one. So that night I was like, hey, that was pretty cool, huh?
Jordan Spieth does this all the time when we play together. We'll be playing and we're on like 14. And most of the time I'm not keeping track at how many under Jordan is. We're just having a great time. All the boys are out there and it's more about just, you know, drinking some beers and having fun. And then Jordan will like drop these comments throughout the round and say, God, I'm hitting it. I cannot stop striping it today or something like on 14, how he's like, well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I'm 8 under right now. Not that you guys didn't know. It's just like constant reminders that he's playing really good and he wants everybody to know how good he's playing that day.
I got to meet their dad because what their dad must just be a monster trash talker because his brother's the same. I mean, unless they just grew up and decided amongst each other that they were going to shit talk to each other. Like
you should play beer pong against them. Those two playing beer pong. I mean, they just don't stop talking. It's just, they're very confident on the other side of the table. Not that we're not playing a ton of beer pong anymore. We have kids. We're easing out of that stage of our lives, but when we did, it was a lot of fun.
I don't think your wife is going to be listening to this podcast.
Yeah, she might breeze through it. She puts on like the Spotify, like times like double to where it gets over really quickly. So, but for you, I mean, she actually mentioned her dad used to put a bike in like one of those stationary bikes and watch the Tour de France and pedal with you. And that was like her early memories of watching her watch you race. So I'm sure he wasn't the only one as well. So
that's like going to the driving range. I mean, you're just standing still. You're not even moving.
Hey, but you're really showing them how to do it. You know, it's like watching Tiger Woods win a major and I'm over here walking 8 irons into a couch or something like that. So I got similar analogy, but still, I guess as we head out here, I want to talk a little bit just about your foundation, Live Strong, just that part of your life. I know the future looks, you know, from everything I see with you, it's always about like what's tomorrow look like and how can we be better today? And it seems like your foundation that you started and the Live Strong brand that you started a while back just all seems to be totally a part of you and a part of your brand.
Yeah. I mean, yes and no. I started the foundation when I was diagnosed and this guy is going to love this podcast. We brought his name up so many times. I said, well, hell, who's going to run this thing? And he said, I'll do it. So he was sort of our executive director at the beginning. And then it grew and grew, and then the tours came, and then the yellow wristband came. And before you know it, I mean, in the beginning, we thought if we raise, I don't know, $50,000 and we can give it to somebody else to do good with, then we won, right? We've done our job. And fast forward 15 years and it raised, $500 million and served 3 million people. It's insane.
Do you just think about it at night at time? Just like $500 million, me? Is that something that you just think about? It's like, doesn't even seem real.
It doesn't. And it's so cool. But it didn't necessarily for me. And this is still very sensitive for me. You know, when I was asked to leave, you know, and everything happened, it was right around that time that Chad Mountain told me on that hole at Kukio, this is your view from the lowest point in your life. It was that week that I got the email from the board and said, all right, you know, we got to part ways. And I said, hang on, what is me racing by? What does this have to do with anything? Like it broke my heart. Mm-hmm. And it's still to this day. And so, but none of that changes the good that was done, right? It was
correct.
It was incredible work. And not only were we effective as a nonprofit, but I think that the idea and the power behind Livestrong. I think we were the most influential. I mean, obviously American Cancer Society, they raise $1 billion a year in a year, right? So that is the biggest cancer charity in the world. But in terms of power and influence, I mean, Newsweek ran a cover article about cancer and all it was a picture of the yellow wristband, right? We had that power. And so a lot of great was done and it's too bad it ended up the way that it did. And I wish them the best. But again, doesn't change those 3 million people's lives that we helped.
Yeah. And everyone, including me, was wearing that yellow bracelet at a period of time. It was like it was a cultural thing. And then the strong part of Livestrong. I mean,
everything.
It's been added to all sorts of causes
as we've gone on.
Boston Strong, just so many different things
that
have been connected to Livestrong. So it's, it's just really freaking cool, man.
Yeah, Uvalde Strong. It's funny. I don't do much charity work. I haven't done much charity work since him. But what I do is you know, I get a lot of requests to just reach out to folks or call them. I prefer to just, you know, this day and age, you just grab your phone. I said, you know, I can call somebody, but, you know, they're not going to have anything to hold on to other than telling somebody that I talked to Lance. I said, shoot me their number. I said, I'll just grab my phone and make them a video, right? So say you were diagnosed Smiley, I'd say, hey, man, thinking about you, pulling for you. Let me know if I can help. And I end all of them with Smiley Strong or Charlie Strong, or if it's Mary, it's Mary Strong. I still use that in my daily reach out. Yeah, you're right. And unfortunately, it's most of the time associated with events that we wish did not happen, right? So Maine Strong, Uvalde Strong, all of this tragic shit that goes on in the world. But yes, it's ubiquitous.
Well, man, you inspired a generation, and you definitely inspired me. And this was a great conversation. Just the golf stories were fantastic.
I could talk golf forever.
I know. I feel like we could have kept on going. Could have kept on going on and on. I definitely want an invitation to the BDI. That sounds fantastic.
DBI.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's the drink.
BDI just kind of rolled off the tongue there.
Drink bitch invitational. But here's the other. I'll tell you as we wrap up, because I knew you had a podcast, because, I mean, not only do I love the game and watch the game, I don't mean to be fucking weird, but I like stalk these guys, right? And so as soon as Hovland came on the scene, and so somebody sent me a clip of him telling you to suck it or something. I was like, this is amazing. But I fucking stalk these guys, dude. Like Joel Damon, I got his number, started texting him. And then, but I've always liked Hovland for whatever. I just think it's so weird that you have a kid from Norway who played at Oklahoma State, who's now one of the best in the world. I'm like, how that didn't make any sense. And maybe I won the world championships as a young kid in 1993 in Oslo. So maybe there's some connection there, but I've just watched him progress and watched him grow. And actually I'm going to tell two stories about me being a stalker. And so in the way he played this year and won the
insane.
So, I'm good. Like, you know what? I'm going to slide into his DMs.
Love it.
Love it. Yeah. So I'm like, hey kid, like, fuck man, wait, that was amazing. Like that was awesome. You know, I send, I'm like, I'll never hear from man. Like an hour later, dude responds. Oh, bing. Yeah. I'm like, he's like, oh, I didn't know you play golf. And so he's this whole back. I love that kid. And then the other, actually this isn't quite a stalker story, but it's a true story. I'm sitting in an airport. This is going way back. And Rom had just come, you know, just turned pro. And I saw it. I'm like, this guy is a world beater straight up. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting in this, in the Admiral's Club in some airport. And this guy across the way, like, is like looking at me. And I never know. I'm like, does this guy want to come over and tell me to fuck off? Or is this guy? So fine. And I'm meeting with a guy. And so we finally get done. And this guy comes over and he starts talking to me and this guy I was meeting with. And the dude I was meeting with says, well, where are you going? He's a very chatty guy. He says, where are you going? And this guy says, oh, you know, I'm a caddy for a young player on the PGA Tour. And I was, you know, I'm already obsessed with golf at this point. And I said, oh, really? I said, which player? And he says, John Rahm. So it's Adam Hayes. And, yep. And he says, this young Spanish kid, John Rahm. And I said, you're John Rahm's caddy? And he says, yeah, you know, I'm Adam. I said, let me tell you something. Don't lose that bag. No matter what, I don't care what you have to do.
That's great advice.
I said, do not lose that bag. That fucking kid is going to make a boatload of money, which means you're going to get a boatload of, you know, percentage of that boatload. Don't lose that bag. And so we exchange numbers. And so we chat most weekends during the tournaments, but I just love, you guys can sense it. I love the game.
Well, you're going to have to come back on sometime too and talk. We can talk even just more golf, current golf stuff, and we'll do it again sometime. I know you're about to run to a call, but beware of PGA Tour players. You might be getting a DM from Lance Armstrong any moment. Yeah. Who knows? Be on the lookout. It's not a fake account. It's actually Lance Armstrong. So make sure, don't leave that on red. This guy's obsessed and will definitely hook you up with some good Peloton advice down the road.
That's right. Yeah. Just like going to the range. Just sitting there hitting balls.
Exactly.
Hang on, this is the
guy.
Well,
it was a fun man, and this has been a great conversation. We're going to have to do it again sometime.
Look forward to it. Thanks, boys.
See you, buddy. Yep.
The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.